broadcasting from Melbourne, Victoria. You're listening to the Investor Exchange. Tune in each week and listen to the guys from United Global Capital discuss the topics that matter the most to your finances. Each episode will help you separate the noise from what really matters, giving you timely and actionable information you can use. We'll cover areas related to financial markets, property, politics, personal finance, and the economy. Now, here's your host.
Good morning, listeners. Welcome to this week's episode of The Investor Exchange. I'm your host today, Louis van Copenhagen. Joining me in our studio is Brett Dickinson.
Good to be back.
Thank you, Brett. Just the two of us.
It's a theme, isn't it?
It is. Third we continue. Week in a row. That's right. That's
Although
right.
Joel will be putting his 2 cents worth in
that's
remotely.
That's right. From our offshore studios.
Yes.
That's right.
Roaming.
Live. Coming to you. Not actually live. Pre-recorded segment from Joel.
Yeah,
thank
but
you.
But anyway, he'll keep us up to date.
He will.
From wherever he may be.
That's right.
Hi,
thank
Steph.
You. Hi, guys. Yeah. I hope you're enjoying the sunshine in the Northern Hemisphere.
Yeah,
it's nice of you. Mate, I've been getting real down about this grey weather outside.
Oh.
I've just been feeling it.
I thought you were about to say you were down because of what happened last Saturday night. Can we go there?
I'm not ready to talk about
we're
it, Brett.
Still not yet?
I'm not ready to talk
what
about
happened
it.
In the space of 2 hours? They've gone from favourites to well down the peg.
Just
quickly,
said,
we're talking about the Eagles, West Coast Eagles,
I just
last year's
said
premiers.
I'm not ready to talk about
were
it.
Were Louis' team, and they were right there looking like they were going to have a great run at it. And in the space of one game, they've gone from flag favourites to looking highly unlikely to get there again. But you never know. There's still a chance.
Are we done now?
We are. We can move on.
We are? We can? Are you sure?
We'll come back to it later. What else are we going to talk about then? If we're going to change topic, we'll move on to something more relevant.
I was
Go
just
pies,
about to say how I'm feeling nicer today because the sun is actually shining here in Melbourne this morning.
Sorry, coming back to that, yes.
But thanks, Brett. Thanks for bringing that up.
That's all right.
Yeah,
I thought we were done with it.
It's really nice of you.
Yeah.
Okay. I'd said I'm not over it yet.
Well, spring's on the way.
Thanks, Brett.
You can sense it.
I can sense it. I am feeling it, and I am feeling uplifted today.
Nice.
And all it takes is a little bit of sunshine. Very nice.
Yeah, it does help.
I tell you who else is feeling uplifted. That is industry and not-for-profit super funds.
What?
A report came out this week which just gave an insight on the amount of funds managed by the retail super funds or the for-profit super fund sector versus the not-for-profit super fund sector, which is mostly industry super funds.
Right.
And a couple of other ones like Catholic super funds and things like that.
Mm.
And keeping in mind that most super funds have earned a return in the last 12 months, they're a little bit variable this year. Some have only earned sort of 5%-ish in the financial year up to 30th of June. Some have earned 10% or around that mark.
Quite a discrepancy.
The amount of funds under management of the retail super fund sector has increased by only 0.51%.
So these are the for-profit?
That's the for-profit.
The for-profit.
Super funds run by banks and wealth management companies.
Right. So when we say for-profit in this sector, are we talking about they're managing it for their own profits?
They're generally listed companies, like a bank or a funds management business, listed on the stock exchange. So they're trying to generate a profit to return to shareholders.
Right.
And that's generally known as retail super funds.
Yep. Because they're all trying to generate a profit for their super fund members, aren't they?
Yes.
Yeah. The purpose of the superannuation is to.
Correct. That's right. Yeah. Yes. That is the mandated job of the trustee of the super funds.
Yes.
Although what the Royal Commission has exposed is the challenges in the conflicts where a trustee is supposed to be managing the super for the best interest of its members, and it has that legislative responsibility, but at the same time, it's making a profit from its members, and that's where the scandal of super fund trustees charging fees to its members that are higher than what they should have for a financial return, which is
probably
not as good.
Lower than what it could be.
Correct. That's right. So the for-profit sector grew, the funds under management grew by just 0.51% when the financial returns have been maybe 5 or maybe 10% in that ballpark. It means there's a lot of people withdrawing their money from these funds.
Yeah.
So it's not that their return has been 0.51%. No. It's that the total amount of money they manage is reduced because people are withdrawing their money.
Right. So it's like a bank balance. If you look at what their bank balance was a year
Correct.
Ago versus now, it's only slightly higher.
That's right.
Even though they've had more income in terms of
Exactly. returns. Exactly. Whereas industry super funds have gone up by 13.8%.
Okay.
Funds under management.
Right.
So they are getting a lot more money coming in.
And
$87 billion, that is.
That's a nice big pot.
That is a nice big pot. So part of that increase is because of returns.
Yes.
But there is a lot of money coming in. And in fact, that's what the reporting goes on to say, is that they have reported receiving a flood of fresh cash following the Hayne Royal Commission.
Right. And I would assume that increase could be from, let me think, is it the three? So you've got the returns.
Yep.
The new members coming into those funds.
Yep.
And increased contributions would also have to add to that, wouldn't it?
Yeah, that's true, Brett, actually. I hadn't factored that in. So
if you look at the last one, the 0.5%, you'd think, well, the existing members would still be contributing.
Correct.
You would assume.
Yeah, you would assume that there's a lot of contributions still coming in.
So it sounds like they're going backwards.
So they are.
Quite a bit in that respect.
They're absolutely going backwards. And the not-for-profit sector is absolutely receiving a lot more money. They're absolutely growing.
Now, outside of those two, Louis, So there's the self-managed space, which is separate to that as well.
That's correct, yes. So the self-managed super fund space isn't reported on here. The self-managed super fund space, the reporting is still nowhere near immediate for these types of statistics. So
but
this
we're this, not talking that they're, where one sort of has declined and the other's increased, that that's just directly coming from one to another. They could be going into self-managed. Some of
So that's the third big player that's here.
Yeah.
And self-managed super funds do make up a significant portion of the superannuation industry. It's not as big as either the retail or the industry segment, but it is very big. So that hasn't been reported on. And what we're probably seeing, what we've always been seeing and what we expect to see again, is more money heading into self-managed super funds.
Yeah.
There's always a lot more money heading into self-managed super funds than what is coming out of self-managed super funds.
Right. So if we had a chart that showed, almost like a pie chart showing the three areas, SMSFs would be the fastest growing, or the
Correct.
Trend would be for that.
Yeah,
okay.
That's right. Yep.
So more people want to be able to control and influence it themselves.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Understandable.
Yeah, yeah. And there's certainly things that we do with self-managed super funds and the way that we go about investing that you simply can't do with a retail or industry super fund.
Yeah.
Just ask Joel for all the details.
Yes.
Because there's a lot of technical details, but the things that we do to, firstly, to increase returns, and secondly, and more importantly, to protect returns, whether it's volatile markets or downward moving markets, with a self-managed super fund, there's ways that you can protect against a declining balance or a volatile market.
Which you couldn't do in either of the other two.
That's right.
Yep.
Yep. They just don't have the investment options available.
Yeah.
Because of their size, they can't access certain strategies that can be accessed when you are a small investor managing your own balance using someone like us as your investment advisor.
Plus, there's, from my understanding of SMSFs, it opens up a whole other realm of possibilities in terms of what sort of asset classes you could take on, like direct property, commercial property ownership if you wanted to buy a business premise or something.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. So huge amount of options for people that have a self-managed super fund. Mm. Huge advantage in that space. So I guess for people who are looking to get out of their retail super fund, fair enough. Because a lot of them have not been performing well.
High fees, low returns.
That's right, yeah. So if you're in that situation, then yes, you can go ahead and move to an industry super fund. I'm all for people making an improvement. I would just suggest that you consider other ways that you can do better with your super.
Yeah.
And we've got a number of strategies that we can employ to do that for you.
Yeah. So you're not just stuck with option A or B. There is option C.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah. Now, Brett, you mentioned something, and that this touches on one of those retail super funds or wealth managers, which is AMP.
Yeah. So, well, obviously with the Royal Commission that was done and dusted now, but they were potentially the biggest party to be criticised out of that whole scenario. And I noticed the other day that Standard & Poor's, the ratings agency, have downgraded them. And I don't know how long it's been, but they've now officially lost their A rating by S&P.
Right.
So it hasn't downgraded a lot. I think it's only, you know, one step down to a B plus or B plus plus.
Yeah, yep.
But they can no longer claim to be
triple B plus is the one step down. Yeah,
the one step down. But yeah, they can no longer call themselves A rated.
Well, there you
so
go.
So the decline continues.
Yeah,
for them.
Yeah. Well, they've had a number of downgrades from the ratings agency since the Royal Commission.
Right.
So, which means it's a reflection that their business is not as secure as what it was. Mm. I think this recent one was because AMP has decided to sell its life insurance division.
The article, yeah, well, I did see a little bit of it, and it's not my area, but I just thought it was interesting given, you know, we've discussed them before.
Yeah, absolutely.
So how does it work, Louis?
So in life insurance, there's a prudential requirement. So the regulator of life insurance companies is APRA. And they require, if you're an insurance company, you need to keep a certain amount of assets on your book. You receive money coming in from premiums, you pay money out in claims, but you always have to keep a balance sheet, which is very strong and very conservative as well.
Yeah, understandable.
So just by its nature, life insurance companies are very safe.
Yes.
But AMP, they're selling off that part of their balance sheet. So a wealth. So they had been previously a company with funds management and financial planning and life insurance, three major divisions.
Yeah.
Also, they have a banking division as well. Mm-hmm. So I guess four major components. What they're doing is they're selling off arguably the most stable one, which is life insurance. And the remaining three, well, just by nature, don't have the same conservative nature and strong balance sheet.
So just by divesting of that, the ratings agencies looked and said, well, we have to downgrade you.
Yeah, that's right. But that's only this most recent downgrade. Mm. So previous downgrades is the business as a whole without those asset sales.
Yeah.
So they've certainly had a gigantic fall from grace,
haven't they? And it's, you know, if you look at it from, you know, when it first started to now, it's the trend is still downwards, unfortunately.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
I wonder about selling the life insurance business anyway. I mean, life insurance is my understanding is it's a cash cow.
So why would they do it?
Well, I don't know. I would be wondering, why don't you sell the funds management business, the one which has come under all the pressure and the scrutiny? Yeah. Mm. Sell that one and keep the life insurance business, which is the cash cow. Go the other way around.
Yeah. I can understand it based on your explanations.
Yeah.
So wonder what their thoughts are.
Yeah.
Why those directors at AMP are making that call.
I make so much sense, Brett, don't I?
You do, Louis.
I should be a director of AMP.
It's a good education every Friday.
They're probably hiring.
Yeah, we have to go on Seek and have a look.
They have had to employ a fair few new directors.
I'd imagine.
Yeah, there might be one or two positions.
Bit of turnover.
Open. Give me a call, AMP.
Yep, they might need your insights,
that's
mate.
Right. That's right. I'll probably get to nominate my salary. That'd
even
be good.
Even better.
Yeah.
Although we'll miss you.
That's right. Yeah. Although they might want to pay me in AMP shares.
Oh. We'll keep you now then. You're stuck.
Oh, very good.
Indeed.
Well, look, that's been a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Let's get on to our actual topics.
So, yeah, do you want me to lead off?
Yes, please.
So I just want to quickly circle back around, only briefly, on another part of what I've discussed the last 2 weeks, which is the dodgy apartment buildings and a lot of the remediation that's had to be done.
Yeah.
So something that I've just noticed this week is that one group... And let me just find it. A national survey undertaken by a financial research and comparison group, Mozo. I'm not familiar with them, but they've got some interesting data here I thought was worth sharing. has done a survey of apartment owners over the last decade to see how much they've spent on defects or remediation, either directly or through their owner's corpse. And based on the survey results, and then they've sort of done some calculations, they believe that building defects have cost new homeowners over $10.5 billion over the past decade.
And
the way they've come up with that, so obviously it's a survey that's got certain amounts of qualified data, and then they've averaged it out and calculated across all of the new buildings.
Yeah, okay.
So they've worked out that over the last decade there's been 670,000 apartments completed. Hell of a lot of new dwellings in the last 10 years. And based on their survey results, it says that defects have cost them on average around $6,000 each owner that they've surveyed.
Right.
So by the time they just work out all of that, that's where they come up with the $10.5 billion.
Okay.
So, you know, and they say there's some that have, you know, people have had minimal, and some that have had, you know, upwards of 50,000. So by the time they average it out. So, look, an interesting thing. I think there's just going to be more and more of this sort of stuff coming through, given what we've been talking about the last couple of weeks.
Absolutely.
So I'll continue to track it, and any material updates, I guess, we'll discuss as they come to light.
Yeah.
But moving on to something that I think may be more interesting, especially for some of our listeners, is what to do with the family home as a potential source of retirement funding. Now, the reason this has come to light is I've seen another article this week released by the Australian Housing and Urban Research Institute. Now, they're claiming that mortgage stress is rising for older Australians.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. So what they're saying is that mortgage debt amongst older mortgagors has increased 600% between 1987 and 2015.
Okay.
So their stats show that in 1987, the average mortgage was $27,000. As of 2015, it's $185,000. Now, these are for people with mortgages aged 55 years and over.
Okay.
And so they're flagging that there is going to be a significant number of older age people that are going to be needing maybe public housing or some sort of subsidised housing, as obviously house values have increased and affordability has become more difficult.
Yeah.
And part of this, I thought, okay, well, if you are getting towards retirement and you do own your own home, now obviously as you get to retirement, you still need to live somewhere. If you're not, you know, if you're not critically ill or have some health concerns that put you into a facility with care, you're going to be living at your own family home, renting or owning. I'm assuming you're owning for this discussion.
Yep.
So what are your options then if you've got an asset that is worth something but you don't necessarily have a lot of income?
Yeah.
And the only scenario I thought of, and Louis, I'm open to all of your suggestions here, is something called a reverse mortgage.
Yes.
Now, I haven't personally been through anyone or helped anyone with a reverse mortgage, but I thought it was worth discussing because we may have some listeners out there that are getting to an age where they are asset rich. They, you know, they've owned their family home for a long time. They don't necessarily want to move out, but they need to get access to money to continue to fund their retirement.
That's right.
So, well, how does a reverse mortgage work? I'll touch on that quickly and then we can maybe discuss some pros and cons.
Yeah, great. Touch on that.
Okay. So the first thing to do with a reverse mortgage is it's actually accessing the equity you already have in your property, your family home.
Yep.
So the assumption we're making here is that the property is worth more than any existing mortgage you've got.
Yes.
Okay. So by that, we mean you've either already paid off any loan against your house, or your loan is well below a threshold that a lender that would give you a reverse mortgage is willing to accept.
Yep. So I think in my mind, I've got a stereotypical 65 or 70-year-old with a house that they've lived in for maybe 10 or 20 or 30 years. It's gone up in value pretty significantly. Their mortgage is now a very small mortgage or no mortgage at all. And now they're looking at taking a reverse mortgage.
Yeah. Yeah. So we'll put some figures around it to give some context. So let's assume that they bought a property 20 or 30 years ago. Today's value is $1 million.
Yep.
And they might have a mortgage of $100,000 or less.
Yep.
Given when they bought it, it was so low and they just haven't quite paid it all off.
Yep.
So in effect, they've got $900,000 of equity in the property. So that's the asset they own, is that equity amount tied up. But the thing is, you can't spend that $900,000.
No.
So what a reverse mortgage would do would be allow them to get their hands on some of that $900,000 to use for funding their retirement lifestyle.
Okay, so why is it called a reverse mortgage?
Well, because typically a mortgage is when you buy it at the start of the property acquisition or a refinance, and you pay the balance down.
Okay, so you're making repayments.
Yes, you're making repayments. So your mortgage, you know, let's say you bought a brand new million, or you bought $1 million house now, and you borrowed 70%, so 700,000. Over the life of your ownership of that, you would be trying to pay that 700,000 down to nil.
Yep.
So that's a standard mortgage.
Yeah.
What we're talking about here is you may have $100,000 of mortgage against a $1 million property.
Yep.
And you're actually going to increase that.
Okay.
And so you might, you know, increase it to $200,000 or $300,000 in the next couple of years.
Yeah.
But so that extra couple of $100,000 you're taking to use.
Yeah. So your debt starts low and gets
starts
higher.
Starts low and gets higher. So that's the reverse.
And the bank makes payments to you.
Yes, the
instead of you making payments to the bank.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Makes sense.
So it does make sense if you know, like, as we alluded to, asset rich but cash poor. So you can start to get access to this cash or the value of your home and not have to sell and move out. So it does make sense if the circumstances are right for you. Now, the pros of it as well, there's no requirement to pay either the capital or the interest on the reverse mortgage during the time that you live in the property.
Okay.
So typically what that means is that the agreement you would sign with the mortgagee is that they would allow you to continue to draw on this up to a certain level, and then obviously the interest that you would be having to pay on this would accumulate. Once it gets to a certain balance, they'll say, well, you've reached your limit. I think we now have to liquidate the house and we'll recoup ours. Any balance goes to you or your estate, depending on where things are at.
Yeah.
So the idea is that the lender is probably anticipating that you will have to vacate the home prior to you reaching that threshold.
Yeah. Okay.
Either you would move into a home because you're getting to an age where you can't care for yourself, or you may even pass away.
Mm.
And therefore the balance is, you know, the value of the home is still more than what you owe that lender.
Yep.
And therefore they can sell that off and know that they're going to recoup all of their funds.
Yeah.
So that's the strategy behind it.
Okay.
Cost-wise, typically a reverse mortgage is around 1% higher than a standard home loan.
Okay.
So not significant.
All right.
You know, more expensive, given the circumstances, not ridiculous.
Yep.
And also there's an element of protection, which is nice to hear, that the government's consumer and credit reforms of 2012 have included a protection against negative equity in reverse mortgages.
Okay.
So what that means is lenders can't put you in a position where you owe more than what your property's worth by continuing to borrow and allow this to get out of hand.
Okay.
So, you know, it does make sense, I think, for some people. I haven't ever dealt with anyone that's actually done this, but given your position, Louis, and some of the people you're advising, has this been on your radar at all, or has anyone you know done it?
It has been on the radar, and we do have clients, very few, but we do have them, who are using a reverse mortgage right now.
Okay.
And it really does help them with their cash flow. Because it is a situation we see from time to time where a person is asset rich, but cash flow poor.
Mm.
And you can have a person with a sizable asset being the family home, but no other assets, and the only income they receive is a Centrelink pension.
Yeah.
Which is not a lot of money to live off.
No, not much of a lifestyle you can have with just Centrelink.
So not much of a lifestyle. So what we see is the choices for the person either you sell the house and move to either a smaller house or a rental property.
Yep.
And that way you get some cash in your bank account from the proceeds of the sale.
Yeah. So there are a lot of people doing the downsizing strategy.
So there's the downsizing strategy.
Yep.
But the alternative to that is the reverse mortgage strategy.
Yeah.
So reverse mortgage, it has its benefits, but it has its drawbacks as well.
Mm.
But so does the downsizing strategy.
Mm.
So in a reverse mortgage, you have to pay some interest. You end up with a debt on the property down the track. I like that there is the consumer law that you can't be in a negative equity position.
Mm-hmm.
And what it means, what I've seen it mean in reality, is that the banks will only lend a very small ratio of the value of the property.
Yes.
So,
and that's a point I didn't touch on, but we may need to just quickly mention that. So typically when you get a traditional mortgage, you can...
Yep.
most people try to borrow around 80%.
Yeah.
Or up to 80%.
Banks are comfortable to lend up to 80%.
Yeah.
And even more with a type of insurance that has to be paid.
Yeah.
With a reverse mortgage, it depends on the person's age.
Yes.
So I don't have the numbers with me, but a person who is 65 right now, a bank might be willing to do a reverse mortgage up to 20% of the value of the loan.
Yeah.
But someone who is 75 right now, the bank would be able to go to a higher amount because that person has less of a life expectancy.
Right. So the timeline to having to sell.
That's right.
So therefore the amount they would draw over that time is likely to be lower.
Because the bank never wants to get anywhere close to 100%. In fact, they don't want to get close to 80%. And they're nervous about getting more than 50%.
Well, one of I did do just a little bit of research before this discussion, and one of the numbers that seemed to be prevalent was that they seem to only go to around 60%.
Yeah.
Seems to be the maximum. Now, obviously, I don't know all the ins and outs of the timelines and the ages.
Yeah.
That seems to be a threshold they don't like to cross.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. So they're not going to give a reverse mortgage at 60% to a 50-year-old.
No.
Because that person still has...
Yeah,
because if that person takes that money and spends it, and then has no income for the rest of their life, which might be 40 years.
Yeah, it could be.
The bank needs its money back. They will get it back eventually when the property is sold. But if that's in 40 years' time, what if the property doesn't grow by as much as the loan does?
Yeah,
and the bank's out of pocket
and
a long
time. And the accumulated
interest
continues to rack up.
So it's a good protection for the consumer.
Mm.
Some people are happy with that. Some people don't like the thought of borrowing money. So, okay, we look at the downsizing option. But downsizing can have a few challenges as well. So if you sell your current house and then buy a house that's lower value, you have to pay a real estate agent to sell it, and then you have to pay the stamp duty and the other transaction costs to get into the new one, plus the physical process of moving house and any expenses that come along with that.
Mm.
So... a lot of people are happy to do that. A lot of people are not.
Yeah.
So, you know, it suits some people and doesn't others.
And circumstances and type of dwelling play into this in a big
way. That's right. Now, the other factor is that if a person is on the Centrelink age pension already, if the amount of the downsize is too much, then it can reduce their Centrelink age pension. So there's a limit to how much cash a person can hold before it starts to reduce the pension.
Of course.
So the family home can be worth an infinite amount.
And not come into play for the age pension.
Correct, and not come into play at all. So it doesn't matter if the house is worth $500,000 or $5 million, the Centrelink age pension is going to be the same amount.
And that's interesting. So I could own an asset worth $5 million. So I could live on my own in retirement and say, I've got an asset worth $5 million, and I can get the same age pension as someone that owns nothing.
Correct. Yep. Mm. Yep. You need to have run out of the rest of your assets, though.
Yeah.
Or be below the threshold.
Sure. But just assuming on a like-for-like, I own the property, someone else doesn't, we get the same from the government.
That's correct. Mm. Yep. Yep. And that is viewed as a bit of a flaw in the system.
Mm.
And I agree, it's not an equitable system in that way. But it's about as good as it gets right now.
Well, everyone has to live somewhere. So.
Everyone has to live somewhere, that's right. And just because it's worth a lot now doesn't mean it's a great house.
True.
This person, if they're in their 80s or 90s, they could have been living in this house. It's common for a person of that generation to have been living in their house for 50 years.
Absolutely.
It could be their first house.
Yep.
And it and could have been.
Could be dilapidated.
It could be a real outer suburb, like houses in a place like Surrey Hills or Kew on the outskirts. The quality of those neighbourhoods is not what it is today.
Mm.
But if that person's been living there for 50, 60 years, well, they've seen an increase in value of their property, but they've seen no cash from it. So that's the thinking behind it.
Yep.
And if the government were to start including the family home, well, then they could be perceived as pushing pensioners out of their homes.
Yeah, it's a difficult one.
And they don't want that news story.
Not at all. No.
There's no political will for that.
No, look, I can see the logic behind it. I think it makes sense.
Yep.
Yeah.
So, look, there's benefits of both strategies. There's downsides to both strategies.
Mm.
And they should both be considered. But reverse mortgages are very interesting, and in my experience, people are more afraid of them than they should be.
Yeah.
Because in the downsizer strategy, your stamp duty costs could be $20,000-$30,000. $40,000 with agent fees included.
See,
could be very big transaction costs.
I think this comes back to one of my, I guess I always think that the majority of the time people are fearful of something is because they don't have enough understanding.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably the case here. If they're nervous or anxious about it, it's because they don't fully understand the ins and outs.
Yep, that's right.
Yeah.
And so many times I come back to thinking it's just money.
Yeah.
But I say it in jest.
Yeah.
Because money is important.
Absolutely it is.
But it's also funny because we're just talking about numbers in a bank account that, you know, strategy A, these are the numbers and they sit in your assets or your bank account. Strategy B, these are the numbers and they work a little bit different. It's just numbers.
Ooh, you're talking too logical. It's just put some emotion with it. That's what influences the decision.
That's right. And that's what I find.
Yeah.
And that's fine. If you're uncomfortable or more comfortable with certain things than other things, then that's you. And as financial planners, we need to design around that. Because we're here to understand your fears and work within your comfort levels.
Great
I just
point.
Find that people have a higher fear of debt than what they need in a lot of cases.
So one thing I'll just touch on, because you mentioned it there, as financial planners, so anyone that's at an age where they may be starting to entertain how they're going to fund their lifestyle, they may be in a position where they own a family home that's got some significant value, really, before they can decide what's going to be their best strategy, getting a financial plan is probably the first step.
Yeah, that's right.
Figure this out.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And that probably highlights where the gap is between me saying it's just numbers, people, and your average consumer being fearful of something that they don't know.
Yeah.
And the difference with me is...
you've run the analysis many times.
I've done the number crunching. Yeah. I've done it enough times.
Yeah.
I know what those variables are.
Yeah.
And in a 60-second conversation, I can immediately see, aha, you're very similar to a situation I've seen before, and I can already see what the potential outcome is of one strategy versus another strategy.
Yeah.
So I guess that's why I'm less fearful. And hopefully, if I can impart some of that financial reassurance and mathematical reassurance, it's just the numbers, people, then hopefully people can make the decision for the best finances.
Good call.
Yeah. So, all right. Thank you, Brett.
Pleasure.
Great discussion. Mm. Really good. So I think off the back of that, we'll take a bit of a break.
Good idea.
Want to learn the strategies that have achieved returns more than double the return of the average superannuation fund? Each day, clients of United Global Capital are using strategies and tactics that were once thought the domain of the professional investor or the super rich. Book your seat at UGC's Financial Fast Track Seminars, where you'll learn the science behind selecting high-performance stocks and real estate, how you can participate in advanced strategies like property development, short selling, and international investments, as well as how to protect your wealth against major adverse market events. To secure your seat, simply go to ugc.net.au/events and select the seminar that suits your needs. Seats are limited, so book your spot now.
Welcome back, everybody. Thanks for sticking with us. If you're still listening, good for you. I'm hilarious.
You're having a good morning.
I'm on fire today.
Yeah, you are, yep.
The sun's shining.
Killing it.
Yeah.
You did say that. Yep.
Don't bring me down.
Never.
Don't do it again.
No. We'll touch on that after the episode.
All right.
What else?
We will throw to Joel from our remote studio now.
Yeah. Very good.
Here is your update from Joel, Chief Investments Officer of United Global Capital.
Well, welcome, Louis. Welcome, Brett. And welcome, listeners. This is Joel Hewish again, this time in San Francisco on the west coast of the United States. We have progressed our trip from what was initially Vancouver, and we settled into Seattle last time I came and gave you an update. We passed through Portland, spent a couple of nights there, and we're now down in San Francisco. And what I really wanted to just share today in my update was that the world's largest economy, at least on the West Coast and at least in the cities that I've gone to, Seattle, Portland, and San Francisco so far, that the world's largest economy seems to be in pretty good shape. In each of those cities that I've just mentioned, people are out and spending. People are out and doing things. The mood and the vibe seems very happy and vibrant, and people are out doing tours, and people are out spending at restaurants and at cafes. The downtown areas are very vibrant, and the general mood of, from an economic perspective, and certainly from a consumer perspective, appears very good. It certainly doesn't appear as though the world's largest, most important economy is in a you know, a period of softness. In fact, down here in San Francisco, we have been here over the Labor Day weekend, and the Labor Day weekend here in San Francisco has been manic. There are crowds everywhere down on the waterside, and taking ferry tours, and in the restaurants. It seems to be chockers. It seems to be on almost, you know, boom time. So it's been a very interesting trip to get a sense as to, you know, just boots on the ground, get a sense of how the world's most important economy is actually faring. And at least on the West Coast of the US, and the US is a very, very big place, but at least in our limited sample piece and very skewed sample set, things seem to be doing well. Now, I'm sure that the West Coast is benefiting, and in fact they are benefiting from, and certainly those cities that I've been to are benefiting from the high-tech boom, both in biotechnology and in high technology. Through computers, the internet, software, robotics, artificial intelligence, as well as biotechnology as well, seems to be very, very strong on the West Coast. Seattle, as many of you would know, is home to Boeing. It is also home to Microsoft and also Amazon. And both of those, all three of those are major employers in that particular city. People were everywhere at lunchtime. Both of those well, certainly at the Amazon district, where Amazon have a whole range of different buildings there, it's very, very busy. We also moved down to Portland, and Portland in its own right is you know, quite a bit smaller than Seattle. In terms of size, and Seattle's quite a fair bit smaller than San Francisco, but even the vibe in Portland was huge. I mean, just speaking to the locals, a lot of the locals here are boasting about the fact that Portland, for the first time in a very, very long time, has actually got net migration into its downtown area. That hasn't happened for a very long period of time, and development and construction is quite strong. In fact, there's a proposal for a two-story, almost like a Collins Arch type building. Now, the highest building in Portland at the moment is only around about 40 odd stories, and that is the Wells Fargo building, and there is a proposal in at the at council in the city of Portland for a developer to develop a 290-story towers that connect at the top, very similar to the Collins Arches that are going in next to our building. But that's 90 stories. It just shows you that, you know, for that type and level of construction to be going on in a relatively small but very funky and hip city of Portland, that confidence in the U.S. economy, and certainly on the West Coast of the U.S. economy, is very strong. And then you head down to San Francisco, which of course is home to all of the major tech companies, or to a lot of the major tech companies, and in particular you can see the Salesforce building, which has just been constructed recently, which towers over San Francisco. That's a relatively new construction that was completed. And San Francisco is booming. You know, it has some very expensive real estate, people everywhere in San Francisco. And you know, the general vibe in all of these three cities of the United States is that times are good. So that all bodes well, just as a general boots on the ground approach, that all bodes well for what we think is a very strong underlying and powerful trend that has helped underpin this current bull market we've been in for the last 10 years or so. And there just doesn't seem to be a whole lot of sign that that major trend that is supporting stocks and has supported stocks for the last 10 years is about to slow down anytime soon. So just a quick update for me today. Nothing too much to concern ourselves with, other than the past week has been reasonable for stock markets. Once again, not diverging away from anything that we said last week, in that we still expect that while we're in this seasonal period of which has traditionally been a seasonal period of weakness in the Australian and the US stock markets, that you know, we're not likely to see a major breakout anytime in the next sort of 4 to 6 weeks. However, stocks are acting constructively, and they continue to hold up well. And that seems to be relatively consistent with what I'm seeing over here in the US as well. So I don't think from the evidence that I'm seeing, boots on the ground, and from the evidence that that is showing up in the stock market overall, and the general economy, that it's time to get too defensive. In fact, I wouldn't be surprised if once we get a little bit of a more clarity around these US trade dramas, we could be in for some pretty impressive moves if that resolves any time in the near future. So all things being well, fingers crossed, sometime in the near future, Trump and China see reason. And if they don't, that we at least have a chance for companies to adapt to this new environment without any major hiccups along the way, and it appears that that will be the case. So I'm cautiously optimistic for stocks to continue to push higher as the year gets closer towards the end. And for this week, I'll sign off and come back with a report next week.
Thank you, Joel, live from Seattle.
Very good.
Beautiful. He video conferenced me the other day.
And?
From a rooftop bar in Seattle in the mid-afternoon, his time. Sunglasses.
Ugh.
White shirt with short sleeves. Guns out.
Couldn't be more different.
Big sunglasses.
To the circumstances.
Sun shining. Gin and tonic in his hands.
Oh, Louis, stop.
Fuck you.
Yeah, agreed.
Anyway.
Our turn will come.
Yes, that's right.
What are you going to talk about today then?
I'm going to bring it around to life insurance.
Right.
And
AMP life insurance?
Nah, not AMP life okay. Insurance. Insurance for people who have insurance. I've heard a story recently from another financial planner, and it's a story I've heard cases of before and I've personally experienced before from clients.
What's this?
The story is a person who has life insurance.
Yeah.
Someone who maybe took life insurance 5 or 10 or 15 years ago. And what the life insurance company does is the cost of insurance is now much higher, significantly higher today than what it was 5 or 10 or 15 years ago.
Yeah.
Now, it does make sense that insurance gets more expensive as a person ages, because if you're 35 years old and you take insurance, your probability of dying or being disabled in that year is a certain probability.
Yep.
When a person gets to age 50, the probability of death or disability in that year is substantially more for a 50-year-old than it is for a 35-year-old.
Of course, yeah.
So your average, your normal insurance is going to increase every year.
As the risk increases.
As the risk increases, yes. That's right. So it's not just that, it's not like home and contents insurance. I don't understand how home and contents insurance goes up every year.
Well, I could understand if it was purely inflation, but
if it's purely
outstripping inflation.
That's right, yeah. But every time that happens, I get the standard response from the home and contents. Oh, theft is up in your area.
Yeah.
Oh, incidents of claims are up in your area.
Oh.
I don't believe you, actually.
Well, the only thing I could say is they may have information that says, yes, there were more incidents, but as a percentage, I doubt it.
Yeah. Anyway, but back to life insurance. What we find is that we do, financial planners get phone calls from their clients saying, my insurance is too expensive, and I just want to cancel it.
Yeah,
because
tough call.
Because it's taking too much from my budget, or it's money I could have put towards savings.
Yep.
A good one and fair enough is I don't need the same amount of insurance that I had yesterday as what I need today.
Yep.
So I have two critical questions for people that want to rethink their life insurance and the amount that they are spending.
These will be good.
All right. Two things. One is to redo your insurance analysis.
Yeah.
Because, again, if we compare 35-year-olds with 50-year-olds, if we look at a person with young children and a high amount of mortgage, they would need a lot of insurance.
Mm-hmm.
That same person, 10 or 15 years later, their children are older, closer to their own financial independence.
Yep.
So if a child is now 15 years old, you only need insurance to support them through to age 20 or 25 or something like that,
mm-hmm.
instead of from age 2 to 25.
Sure.
Your mortgage should be substantially lower in your 50s than what it was in when you're 35. If it's not, see a financial planner for
debt reduction strategies. Yep.
So reassess how much insurance you need in the first place, because it should be less.
Yes.
Your need for insurance should always be decreasing. The exception being if you upgrade your home at one time, or if you have another child at one time, then those are one-off events that increase your need. But generally, year on year, your need for insurance should be decreasing.
But either way, the assessment will bring that out.
That's right. So redo the numbers. Don't just say, this insurance is too expensive, I'm going to cancel the whole lot.
Mm.
You should say, this insurance is too expensive, let's see how much insurance I actually need today, and then let's price the amount of insurance I actually need.
So the question isn't about whether it's too expensive, is the insurance appropriate?
Yes, that's right. Has that point been made?
I think so.
Okay,
you
great.
Said there were two.
There is 2 points.
Yeah.
Okay, here is my second point. Before you reduce your insurance, get a health check.
Why?
Here's the story. Client phones his financial planner, says, this insurance is too expensive. I don't like paying the premiums. I've been paying it for 10 years. I've never claimed. I'm just going to cancel it.
Mm.
6 months later, a year later, what happens?
A big health problem.
A big health event happens, which would have been a claimable event.
Right. Had they continued with the policy.
That's right. 1 week ago, a financial planner said, it's happened to me, and it's happened to me this week. Client phoned up and says, leukemia.
Oh.
In his 50s.
Yeah.
He's got leukemia.
Hmm.
Cancelled his insurance 8 months ago.
Oh, God.
Kids are older.
Yeah.
His home loan's lower.
Yeah. But there's still a need.
There's still a need. And he's got no insurance at all.
Right. So, yeah, cancelled rather than just changed.
Correct.
Big difference.
If he'd changed his insurances, well, then he would still have an adequate amount of insurance.
Mm.
Or even if it's his insurance is reduced to just a bare minimum for what he was willing to pay, then he would have something instead of nothing.
That's a shame.
So with insurance, when you're doing step one, the analysis, you always got to consider, well, if the event has happened, then what is the amount of insurance I would like to have? And then you look at, well, what is the cost of that amount?
Yep.
And does that work?
Mm.
Step two is to get a health check, because a lot of these health events are only seen when a symptom comes up. And it's only when there's a reason to go to your doctor that the doctor says, well, you should get a blood test and find out why you're coughing or tired or dizzy or whatever the symptom is.
You may already be in the early stages of something.
You might already have something that you can pick up.
Yeah. Yep.
So, here's why it happens. The price has gone up because the probability of a claim has gone up.
Mm.
So if you're upset that your prices have gone up, it's because you're more likely to claim.
Mm.
If you're more likely to claim,
you need it.
You're at a high risk,
and
you're more likely to need it.
Yeah.
So, of course, you're more likely to claim right after you've cancelled it.
Yeah.
Absolutely. It's how the system sort of pans out.
Mm.
It's not by design. It's just by reality that when you're high risk, you pay more, and when you're paying more, you're more likely to want to cancel.
Yep.
So don't cancel it. Get an appropriate amount of insurance, and before you reduce it, get a health check.
Good.
Go to your doctor for a blood test. Go get a mole scan. Mm. Go speak to some people about other ways that you can check on your health.
Yeah.
Do some things to get a confirmation.
For anything that's relevant to your hereditary, lifestyle, age,
correct.
Whatever it might
family
be.
Family history. If you've got a family history of prostate cancer, then you're going to have to get some fingers in places. But if you're reducing your life insurance from $1 million to $500,000, that's a $500,000 decision.
Yeah, but it's still required.
So go get your health check.
Good.
And that is my tip for the day.
Nice, Louis. Well done.
Thank you, Brett. Should we take another break?
Yeah, just quickly.
We need a second break.
Yeah, I think we do. Right.
Thanks, Brett.
Are you concerned about your finances? Maybe you're not sure if you'll have enough money to retire on. Or maybe you've received a redundancy, inheritance, or even a significant promotion, or perhaps a life-changing medical diagnosis. Regardless of your concern or financial position, United Global Capital's advisors are experts in the areas of strategic financial planning, taxation, superannuation and self-managed superannuation funds, risk management, estate planning, and investments. Don't let fate dictate your financial future. Take control today and contact United Global Capital for a no-cost, no-obligation financial strategy consultation. Simply call 03-8657-7640 or email info@ugc.net.au and book your appointment today.
And hello again. We're towards the end of this episode.
Yeah.
What are we doing?
Last section.
What happens?
You can't be serious, man. You cannot be serious.
Oh, yeah.
You better kick this one off, Louis, because you're the one feeling good today.
Brett, I've got another story of an apartment block that has to be evacuated. There's been so many recently, and you've been talking about it for a few weeks.
Well, is this a you can't be serious, or more of a discussion around the crappy buildings?
Authorities in a German city evacuated 30 residents from an apartment block.
That's happening in Germany too.
After a venomous cobra escaped from a home and was spotted in the hallway of the apartment blocks. So
that's a different type of evacuation.
Fair enough. Get out, everyone.
Get out.
Get out.
Run. Not snakes on a plane.
Jeez. Yep. So they, as of the time of writing the article, they hadn't found the snake. It was believed to be somewhere in the basement.
Ooh. Yeah, I wouldn't feel too comfortable parking my car down there.
No, that's right.
A bit nervous.
That's right. Just find it somewhere.
Very good. Well, Louis, most males do struggle sometimes to grasp and understand the female menstrual cycle.
Okay.
So one particular boyfriend was asked by his girlfriend to pick her up some tampons, given her needs.
Yes.
Which is a general. I think any male in a relationship had to do it at some point in time.
Yes. You're on thin ice, Brett.
Okay.
I'm nervous about what's coming next.
I'll get there.
Okay, great.
So he went to the store and he found that there was a brand of Tampax Compact. One was in a yellow, one was in a green size box.
There was
obviously some differences.
Mm-hmm.
So he sent a picture with a little caption below saying, "Do you want the lemon or the lime?" Which is funny enough. But what happened is, given the world we live in now, she posted that and said,
"Oh my goodness."
And of course, all the feedback had all of these other boys starting to think, "Oh, do they actually come in flavors?"
You cannot be serious.
Oh, We males, we're a bit hopeless, aren't we?
We can be. Oh, geez. No, they're not centred.
No.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. Oh, thank you, Brett.
Pleasure.
Good episode.
Yeah.
Thanks, everyone,
good
for tuning in.
Good energy today, Louis.
Yes, lovely. Go enjoy the sunshine, everyone, if that's in your part of the world.
Yeah.
And if not, there's always tomorrow.
Indeed. And next week.
And next week.
We'll talk to you again.
Lovely. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.
Bye.
You've been listening to this week's episode of The Investor Exchange. To access this episode's show notes, go to theinvestorexchange.com.au and follow us on Facebook at The Investor Exchange for updates on our latest episodes. This show is for entertainment and educational purposes only. Before making any investment decision, contact United Global Capital by emailing ugc.net.au for a personalised, no-cost, no-obligation financial strategy consultation. Or alternatively, email us at info@ugc.net.au.